From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As people around the world walk out of work and school today to demand action on climate change, California and more than 20 states are suing the Trump administration over a move that California's governor says will be devastating to the environment and is being done on behalf of the oil companies. That would be the White House decision this week to revoke a waiver that allowed California to set its own tougher auto emission standards. We're joined now by the acting director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, Russ Vogt. And Russ Vogt, I want to get your reaction to California Governor Gavin Newsom, who pointed out this week that Republican Governor Ronald Reagan actually started the state's efforts to address widespread pollution, which ultimately led Congress to granting California this special status for setting its standards. Here's the governor speaking on Wednesday.
I don't know what the hell has happened to the Republican Party. And by the way, where is the Republican Party right now? Where are they pushing back? Why aren't they pushing back? They believe in federalism. They believe in state rights. At least they assert that, and they're nowhere to be found.
What's your response to that?
Sure. This is not about federalism. This is about ensuring that when we're dealing with interstate commerce, something that the constitutional system was specifically set up to ensure that Congress can ensure that no state is bullying another state and requiring mandates that will be put on the backs of consumers across the country, that can't happen. So this is not about the types of programs that were set up by previous governors, many of them from a conservative perspective. This is about 2013, when the Obama administration, working in conjunction with the state of California, allowed California to set astronomically high emission standards that will lead to cars that are $3,000 more expensive. And the Trump administration is coming along and saying, we want American families to have safer, cheaper, and better cars. And to do that, we need to have lower emission standards. And we actually believe that that will lead to less pollution because American families will be buying cars that are not 12 years old and have better systems to containing pollution.
Why do you say it's astronomically high? The levels set by the Obama administration are in line with what a lot of other countries are aiming for around the world.
It's because the car manufacturers have already shown that they can't meet those standards. So even the current standards that are, this is a scale that's going up, but right now, only 3 out of the 11 car manufacturers were able to meet the current standards without the use of the electric vehicle credits. And the electrical vehicle credits are kind of a scam to make sure that these vehicles are created when there isn't a market demand for them. We have nothing against electric vehicles. We just think that the market should be the one that demands it. And so the only reason the car companies have been able to meet the current standards is by these credits, and those credits are paid for on the back of consumers across the country. Again, another issue for regulating interstate commerce. And so now you have the standards going up even more. We just don't think it's a sustainable situation. The car manufacturers don't think it's a sustainable situation, and that's why most of them were arguing that there should not be standards that go up to the original Obama levels. And you only have a few that are now colluding with the state of California to reach some kind of settlement.
But the car manufacturers actually did support having year over year fuel efficiency increases because it makes it easier for them to plan. What about that? Why not just allow the numbers to go up a bit every year instead of just freezing them in place?
Well, look, we haven't figured out, we haven't come forward with what our proposal, our final proposal will be. We're in the middle of doing that. What this specific reform is doing is merely taking the waiver away and saying that California is no longer going to get to set the standard and bully the rest of the country. As it pertains to certainty for businesses, obviously businesses prefer that. But we have heard manufacturers, we've heard from auto dealers, we know that the current Obama standards are too high, and we will be reducing them with the final proposal that we come forward with.
Now, you mentioned that it's going to cost people more to buy more fuel-efficient vehicles. President Trump has been saying that we're currently in the greatest economy in the history of this country. Why is it, therefore, so important for cars to be a little bit cheaper, not to mention the fact that the AP has looked into this claim that it would be cheaper and says, in fact, people are going to spend more on gas over the life of the car than they would save on the car itself?
Well, look, part of a growing economy is the deregulatory effort that this administration has put forward as a priority. One of the key pillars of that deregulatory agenda is this specific regulatory proposal. So we think to keep the economy growing well, it's important to keep money in the pockets of people that allow us to use energy and use it as cheaply as possible. Energy prices are low right now. We think all of that is good for the economy, and we think it's good for the economy for families to be able to spend less on cars, and they can then use that money to invest or to save and to do other things that build the economy as well.
I'm sure it's not lost on you that we're having this conversation on a day that kids around the world are walking out to demand action on climate change. Don't you think this is moving in the wrong direction on that issue?
We don't, in part because we all want cleaner water, cleaner air, and we're looking for practical steps that are not informed by ideology to be able to get that result. And we think that when families are not buying newer cars with newer systems to contain pollution, that that actually sets us back than everyone going around and driving cars that, you know, has 12-year-old emissions systems in them. So from our perspective, this rule, this set of proposals will actually lead to the type of practical results that those demonstrating on behalf of the environment actually want.
That is Russ Vogt, who's acting director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, now for more on today's climate strikes. We're seeing that climate strikes are lighting up on social media. And here for our regular check-in on what's trending is Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hey, Femi.
Hi. Trending right now, climate strike, Fridays for Future, global climate strike, Boston climate strike. It could possibly be one of the biggest marches and rallies of young people around the world that we have ever seen.
Really? What are you seeing online? On Twitter, I do see that the hashtag is trending right now, as you said.
It's a global movement, so it's a coalition of young climate activists and also their allies, also adults as well, around the world. So different groups marching for different reasons, but they basically want climate action to happen from their political representatives. So, for instance, in Glasgow from earlier on today, people were listening to Greta Thunberg's words. She's the young Swedish climate activist who's been around the United States for the last couple of weeks, and they were crying as they were listening to her speeches. In Afghanistan, youngsters have been out on the streets there as well, across in Paris and all across Europe. So this movement is spreading as people are waking up, as people are getting time off school. Lots of organizations have said, yes, you can take time off school. Yes, you can take time out to take part in the marches. So there is this global coalition of young people saying, now we want you politicians to do something.
There's something else that folks are taking off for today from school and from work, and that's to go to Area 51 in Nevada. And for those who don't know, this is a highly classified United Air Force facility. It started out as a joke online, but now we've been hearing that folks are actually there. What are you seeing online?
They are turning up. And this is Nevada, so they're turning up in the desert. It's not like there's a 7-Eleven nearby so they can get drinks and groceries and supplies. They have been warned by authorities, if they try and storm Area 51, they will be arrested. They have been warned about that. So there will be music festivals and gatherings snark, basically, on Twitter, because people cannot believe that they took the joke so seriously. Even the organizer withdrew from it and said that, you know, You guys don't need to go to the desert. But there will be plenty of memes coming out of this. And also just disbelief that you can create something on Facebook as a joke and literally make it happen. The power of social media.
Now, I've been seeing photos and a couple of videos online from folks who are apparently there. But what are folks sharing about their experiences?
It's a little difficult. They're sort of building their festival from scratch. And they're not entirely serious. I'm not sure that I need to be encouraging people to go into the desert. But Keem, for instance, says, as a reporter is reporting, people are running behind the reporters and making themselves very visible on TV. There could be almost as many reporters as people there for Alien Fest. Area 51, this is from Malik Forte. He says, good to know the Area 51 raiders came with good intentions, and they have signs which say, clap alien cheeks, which is really a reference to what you might do with your gluteus maximus if the TV people turn up.
Okay. We only have a few more seconds left, but there is another rally going on in person and online for pop star Britney Spears. She went to court to release herself from conservatorship, and people are showing support for her. Very quickly, what are you saying?
Oh, these are true, true Britney fans who really love her. So King Spears says, this angel deserves her freedom just as much as anyone else. She's human. People taking time off work and crossing to the other side of the states just to support her. And also it's an education about what conservatorship, the guardianship actually means, because it means her father has been looking after her rather like an elderly patient, and she cannot make certain decisions. So that is why people are saying free Britney Spears, because they feel that she should be able to run her own life.
Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Hey, it's not just you. This week does feel like it's gone on forever. When it is over, join me, Sam Sanders, to get some perspective. Catch my show, It's Been a Minute, where we look back on the news and culture and everything else. Download it every weekend from NPR.
There's a new book out this week from the travel guide maker Lonely Planet about the night sky, specifically where to see the stars. Most of us don't get a good view at home because of light pollution, which affects 99% of the population of the U.S. So let's find out where to go from the author of Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. That would be Valerie Stimmick. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, I have to say that, you know, for most Americans, especially those who live in cities or in suburbs, they don't have a very good view of the night sky. How far do you have to go from the major metro areas to actually see the stars in the way that you should be able to?
In most of the cities in America, you can get to a good night sky view within 1 to 2 hours. The 90-minute range seems to be ideal. I do a lot of research on that. I actually work on a series of city stargazing guides, and usually within 90 minutes you can get far enough out that you'll be able to see the Milky Way, and you'll be able to see if there's a meteor shower going on, you'll be able to see that.
And where is the best place in the – let's start with the United States, because this book looks at the whole world. But in the U.S., what would you say is the best place to see the stars?
That's a really tricky answer, but I would say if you're going to plan a trip to any part of the U.S., the Southwest, particularly Utah, like Southwest Utah, Northern Arizona, Eastern Southern California, there are some great national parks, and national parks are a huge advantage because they're already preserved and kind of underdeveloped, and that usually means that there's going to be a lot better protection of the night sky overhead as well.
A lot less light pollution.
Correct.
Yeah, and one of the things that you talk about in this book, by the way, is that for places that do have lights, the lights are starting to get smarter, meaning that we are putting in lights on streets, et cetera, that don't shine up, they just shine down, and so therefore they don't create as much light pollution.
Exactly. That's one of the things we worked really hard to define in this book, is what is light pollution, which there are some great people who've already done a lot of research. And the idea isn't that you have no light or that things aren't illuminated, which should be. It's just that the illumination is exactly on what you need to have illuminated. So if you need a road to be illuminated to see to drive at night, let's make sure that the light isn't spilling out onto the sides of the road where there might be wildlife. It's not pointing up for no reason because nobody's driving up above the light. A lot of cities have been starting to look at this, too, because they understand the impact it's having.
Do you think that we're getting a lot better at that, at not causing so much light pollution around this country?
We're getting there. There's some communities, especially smaller communities, that have been doing some great work. I was actually recently traveling in Nebraska, and there are some communities there that are Nebraska, because Nebraska is quite sparsely populated. The towns are starting to say, hey, this is something people are interested in. Let's see what it's going to take to get our community light compliant. Big cities, it's harder because there's a lot more bureaucracy and the cities are established. One of the biggest cities that has a great record for light management is Tucson, Arizona.
Hmm. I was happy to see that one of your best spots in the U.S. for stargazing, for those of us on the East Coast, is in Pennsylvania, Cherry Springs State Park in central Pennsylvania.
That's a tiny little pocket of great dark skies. And I wish we had more space in the Eastern Seaboard, because I know, I mean, it's one of the most populated regions of the country. But because of that, it's a lot harder to find really nice dark sky spots.
In this book, you get into astrophotography. I've always noticed it's very difficult to take my phone and take a picture, even of the moon, which looks so big and bright. And then you take a photo and it just doesn't turn out the way you want it to. What are some of the tips you have for people that want to take astrophotographs?
Sure. Well, your phone is not going to be the right tool for that. Okay. That's the starting point. You need a device, a camera that has manual controls so that you can control the shutter speed, you can control the exposure, you can control the aperture, which are some sort of technical things. And all the photographers are probably shaking their head that this is quite a simplistic explanation. But that manual control is critical to getting the settings right, to allow the right amount of light in to get the photo that you're looking for. The other one that a lot of people talk about and that I never go anywhere without is a remote and a tripod. So our heartbeats and our finger on the shutter are enough to disturb a camera, especially if you're doing a longer exposure, such that the stars that you're trying to photograph will be fuzzy or will be wobbly. The last one, and this is sort of a more technical one, is when you are out shooting at night, you should set your focus out to infinity, but then just bring it back just a little bit, because the way that the camera works is if you go all the way to infinity, no part of the photo may be in focus. So pulling it back a little bit typically solves that.
Now, we've been talking about places where you can stargaze in the United States. The stars that we typically see are different from the ones that you would see if you were looking up in the Southern Hemisphere, right?
Correct.
So what do they get to see down there that we miss?
I actually know this. I took my first trip to Southern Hemisphere in March to Chile. I was scouting for the recent solar eclipse, and it was astonishing to see the night sky in the Southern Hemisphere, because it feels a little bit like we grew up with the night sky and we think we know it, and then you go see this other night sky, but it is still our sky. So you can see some of the Northern Hemisphere constellations. You can see Orion, which is a very popular winter constellation. It's upside down from where I was viewing in Chile. So I'm standing there, I'm like, why are the stars in the
wrong place?
Why
is his belt like that, right?
Yeah. And I finally tipped my whole body over and, oh, there. Okay. So that's one fun thing, is you can see some of the constellations you know, but they're going to be inverted. You can see more of the Milky Way, and it has very distinct shapes in the Southern Hemisphere. There are obviously different stars. And one of the great things that I personally fell in love with was being able to see the Magellanic Clouds, which are two disorganized galactic formations near the Milky Way. So you can actually see these sort of other galaxies.
Now, you look at places all over the world. Is there a place that stands out to you that you would tell our listeners, if you're going to fly somewhere and travel just for the night sky, you should go here? Where would it be?
That is a tough choice. I'm going to give you two. One is New Zealand. I think New Zealand is a great candidate. If you look in the book, we've represented New Zealand in every section, I believe, which is wonderful. I've actually never been there, but it's number one on my list currently. And then the other one, I'm actually leading a tour there, is Jordan. The country of Jordan is a very tourist-friendly country in the region. It's got great hospitality infrastructure, and the night skies above certain parts of the country are just spectacular. And I'm really looking forward to bringing some people there. I'm going in March, bring some people there and showing them what makes the country special and the night sky and the Arabic heritage in astronomy. We're going to kind of do this whole big tour that introduces people to that.
Now, one of the other sections of the book is about going to observatories. There are some incredible observatories all over the world. Can you actually just go in and have a look up at the sky through their telescopes?
It depends on the observatory. So, for example, Mauna Kea, which is a mountain in the Big Island of Hawaii, generally considered one of the best places for observing in the world. Most of those observatories are not open to the public after dark, because they're using them to do research. You can tour them during the day, but you can't necessarily tour them at night. So almost every observatory has their own rules. But a lot of smaller observatories, especially sort of in the periphery of metropolitan areas, for example, we have one here in Oakland called Chabot. They do public nights where you can show up. It's free for the public. You can go up to the telescope and you can look at whatever they have trained on for that particular window of time.
You also get into places where you can see something that I've never seen and I've always wanted to, which is the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights.
Yeah, I actually grew up in Alaska. So for me, seeing the Northern Lights wasn't this amazing bucket list worthy item until I moved away.
It's just
and
like
I realized,
Tuesday you get to see
I know.
The Northern
and
Lights,
I go right. Coming home from high school. Oh, wow. The Northern Lights are going to be out tonight. We'll go see them.
So what's the best place to see them in America, in North America?
I would always advocate for Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't need a passport. That makes it really, really easy. Most people go to Alaska in the summer. If you go in the winter, it's going to be a lot less crowded, much lower cost than going in the summer. There's some really cool events in the winter in Alaska, like the Iditarod, and you can go see the start and, you know, all those kinds of things. And you can see the Northern Lights, too.
One more thing that you get into here that I want to ask you about is eclipses and the best places. And there are people that travel all over the world. We just spoke to somebody who was getting on a cruise in Tahiti to go down into the South Pacific to see the last solar eclipse. But we remember the one a couple of years ago that was visible in the United States, and it was such an amazing sort of national moment of unity to take a few minutes and look up and see the eclipse. The next one that will be visible here is 2024, if I'm not mistaken. Total solar eclipse, April 2024?
Correct.
Wow. And so you tell people in this book where they can go and have a look at that one.
We do. Yep. We look at the path of totality, and we looked at various metropolitan areas and other interesting points along the route that we would advise people to go to. And what's funny is when I would reach out to these destinations, they are already planning. They fully understand how big this will be for them.
How did you get so interested in this?
It's a combination of things. I think growing up in Alaska, having access to really good dark skies through a major portion of the year every year was critical to me. Being able to see the Milky Way and seeing the Northern Lights, I distinctly remember seeing the Hale-Bopp comet.
I believe that was in 97.
My grandfather was into meteorology and astronomy, and he pointed out the space shuttle at one point. We could see the shuttle lit up in the rising sun. He said, oh, that's the shuttle. He was following along enough that he knew that it would be visible and pointed it out while we're standing at the school bus stop waiting for the bus to come.
Wow. What do you say to people, and there are people out there, who just don't really care about the stars and they don't ever take time to look up or find a place where they can really see them?
Well, I feel very sad. I think that there's this great humbling experience in seeing the night sky and getting a sense for our place in the universe. That's what I encourage everyone to do. That's why I'm leading tours. That's why I wrote the book. I want people to get out and see the night sky.
That is Valerie Stimmick, whose new book is called Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
Let's turn now to Texas, where heavy rains from Tropical Storm Imelda have submerged much of the greater Houston area. Schools and roads are still closed today as emergency responders continue to rescue residents from roofs and cars. So far, there have been two deaths, including one man who was electrocuted while trying to rescue his horse. For more, let's turn to Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo. Hi, Chief.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Chief, we're hearing that in some areas around Beaumont, which is about an hour and a half northeast of Houston, has already received upwards of 43 inches of rain. And for context, this part of Texas typically receives about 63 inches of rain over a whole year. Describe for us what you're seeing on the ground there.
Well, for the city of Houston, we got hit really hard yesterday, but the greatest impact really was east of us in Beaumont. And the water was reminiscent for those folks of Hurricane Harvey. And then we went to Kingwood where we saw homes flooding. And, you know, some of these folks had just moved back in after a flood in May. And so it's just it's a sad thing to watch. And but we're just very grateful that there was only two reported losses of life in this mm-hmm. event.
Mm-hmm. You're comparing this to Hurricane Harvey.
Well, when you're talking about that amount of rainfall in Beaumont, you know, Harvey was about 50, 60 inches and up to 60 inches in some places in Beaumont. You know, that's a lot of rain. And but, you know, the resiliency of Texans, of Houstonians, of Americans is something that I marvel about. And their attitudes yesterday when we're evacuating people from homes they had just moved back into. I think this just speaks as to the spirit of our community. You know, we coined the phrase Houston strong, Texas strong, Boston strong. And it's just the best is coming out of folks in these trying circumstances. And so to me, that's the silver lining. That it's a reminder, especially at a time where there's so much division in our country, that when the going gets tough, we actually all come together.
Mm-hmm. I think I know what you mean. I saw some of those photos and video of volunteers, not just police officers,
yep.
who were out on their own helping to rescue people. You guys had a lot of high rata rescues, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
What's the latest count?
Well, in the greater Houston, Harris County area, we're probably pushing between all the departments over 2,000 here.
Wow.
And if you extend that over into the east of here, it's going to be many, many more.
Yeah, I know it might be hard to tell right now because you're in the thick of it. But
yeah.
Do you get a sense of how much damage has been done?
Well, the damage assessments are going on. I know that in the city itself, we're probably going to have upwards of 200 structures, which compared to Harvey is negligible, but that's 200 families who have to deal with the rebuilding of their houses. But as we spread out from the city of Houston and go east again to Beaumont, that count is going to be much, much higher. But we still don't have an official count other than I can tell you it was very widespread. Houses were underwater, completely underwater in some cases. And so in the upcoming days, I'm sure we're going to understand just how widespread and how devastating this event was.
Well, thank you so much, Chief, for your work. And thank you for talking with us. That's Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo. Chief, good luck and thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
All this week, we've been taking part in Covering Climate Now. That's a collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world, beefing up coverage of the climate crisis. Today, we're going to talk about the effect of climate change on the Earth's soil. A recent report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, detailed how the mismanagement of land is contributing to climate change. And the report said that the Earth's soil is being lost 10 to 100 times faster than it's forming. One of the authors of that report is Lou Verschow. He's lead scientist for restoration of degraded landscapes at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, and before we talk about how degraded the soil is on this planet today, tell us first how important soil is to the atmosphere and why it's such an important factor when we talk about climate change.
The soil mediates a lot of the processes that affect the climate system. It's the basis for plant growth. And so if we have degraded soils, we get poor plant growth. We get reduced carbon dioxide uptake from the atmosphere. Drier soils and warmer soils tend to promote heat waves. For example, there's a lot of the impacts between the biosphere and the atmosphere, we say, are mediated by what we would call the carbon cycle. So plant growth, decomposition, decay, and the water cycle, so rainfall. And there's a lot of heat that's transferred from the soil to the atmosphere as water vapor or as what we would call sensible heat, so heat that you can feel. And so soils mediate these flows within the environment and have important direct effects on the climate system, but also important feedback effects on the climate system, depending upon how the climate is changing and how the soil conditions are changing.
But in addition to all of that, would you say that the main issue is that our soil is a huge carbon storage facility, basically?
Exactly. Soils store more carbon, probably about twice as much carbon or three times as much carbon as the atmosphere stores. So soil degradation leads to a lot of release of carbon. And you can see with the relative magnitude of the stocks, the potential for impact on the atmosphere and, in fact, the actual impact through land degradation is quite significant.
So what is the state of our soil today?
So we estimate that roughly half of our agricultural lands have degraded soils. And a little bit less, maybe about a third of our forest lands have degraded soils. So we're losing soil quality and soil function fairly rapidly due to unsustainable management practices. And this has an impact on the ability of the biosphere to support the production of food, support all the processes and services that we get from healthy agricultural and natural ecosystems.
Is there anything that can be done about that? Because, you know, we think about the climate changing in some areas that are further to the north, for example, being more attractive for farming, but the soil may not be there for that.
That's correct. So there's a lot that can be done to maintain soil health, and there's a lot of efforts within the scientific community to do that. There's a lot of efforts within the farming community. We have a lot of investment in what we call conservation agriculture, which includes reducing tillage, maintaining soil cover, protecting the soil from erosion, rotating crops so that we are maintaining the soil biological function, the microbes and the insects and the other organisms in soils that are essential for soil health. So there's a lot that can be done. You mentioned the increase of agriculture to the north. These are soils that have typically not been under agriculture, and so opening them up to a new agriculture raises questions about the sustainability of this. So if we're going to subject these soils to the same types of degradation that we've seen elsewhere, we're going to also limit our ability to produce the food and the fiber. But at the same time, these areas also are typically not areas that are under agriculture. So we're going to be losing other functions, other roles that these soils and the ecosystems on these soils have been playing with respect to forest cover, to biodiversity, to water resources, to carbon stores and the like. And the real danger is the loss in the temperate and the tropical zones of soil functions.
Why?
Because this is where the population is. So we have the largest population growth right now in the tropics. We're expecting another 2.5 to 3 billion people on the planet by 2050, largely in the tropical regions. And so producing in the boreal zone isn't a solution to maintaining the sustainability of these populations and the health of these populations in the tropical zone. So as we see increased accelerated tropical soil degradation, we see more and more pressure on the landscape. Maintaining healthy soils in these regions is really what's essential.
What about the nutrients in the soils that we are using today? And if we degrade those soils, are we going to lose out on certain nutrients that get into our food, in vegetables and fruits, et cetera?
Exactly. That's a real danger. Some nutrients are replaceable. Things like nitrogen, we can replace through biological processes like nitrogen fixation. What's really the risk are some of the micronutrients, so boron, zinc, nutrients that we need that are essential for us in small quantities for maintaining our own health, maintaining the health of the animals that are living on these landscapes, the livestock that we're raising. And so, you know, as we see increased erosion, as we see increased depletion of nutrients, of organic matter in soils, we're going to see increased nutrient deficiency. And this is one of the things we're seeing very much in the tropics and some parts of the temperate zone now. People that are living, depending upon these landscapes, are often deficient in micronutrients, vitamin A, iron, zinc in particular, boron. So these issues are important now, and they're gaining importance.
Lou Verschow, when you see some of the effects of climate change, including mega droughts or huge floods, what do you think is the impact on the soil? We see the pictures. We see how terrible it looks when you know there's no water or there's too much water in a place. But what is it doing to the soil?
It's undermining our ability for long-term sustainability, in a nutshell. As we increase erosion in these massive flooding events than we do in low-intensity events over the course of a year or a decade, this soil, as we noted in the IPCC report, we're losing it at about 10 times the rate that it's forming. So if we lose it, it's gone for decades to centuries and significantly limits the ability to rebuild after these floods or after these drought events. And additionally, the loss of many of these ecosystems exacerbate these events. So as we lose wetlands in the landscape, we lose water storage. As we lose forests, we lose the absorptive capacity. We increase the velocity of runoff across these landscapes, the water that hits the land and just runs off rather than soaking in, because these ecosystems and the soils underneath these ecosystems can no longer absorb the water.
If you could wave a magic wand and get everyone to do what needs to be done to keep our soils healthy around the world, what would it be?
I think we know pretty well what is required to be done. The economic incentives aren't always aligned to do that. So what we need to do is rotate crops. We need to reduce tillage. We need to maintain soil cover. We need to replace fertility that's lost. You know, as we take crops off, we take nutrients off. Those need to be replaced through organic or chemical means. We need to use agrochemicals wisely, and we're not doing that in many places today. We need to fine balances in these landscapes. So landscapes function well when there are multiple ecosystems in the landscapes. So we need a diversity of ecosystems in landscapes. We need to manage landscapes more as integral units rather than each individual doing what they think is best for themselves on one particular landscape or one particular farm. We need to understand how different parts of the landscape relate to each other and develop planning and management around these ideas. So I think, you know, how to manage landscapes and how to keep them healthy is well within the scientific knowledge. It's not that much of a mystery, but getting the incentives right to do that right now is the major constraint.
What about for an ordinary person who's listening to this right now and saying, well, what can I do? What can they do?
I think if you're managing land, you need to look for the health of your land. So if you're a farmer, protect your soil. Put in erosion control structures, put in the nutrients that you need, but not too many nutrients. You know, a lot of the problem we have right now is over-fertilization, overuse of chemicals. Use organic nutrient sources because these help build up organic matter and retain nutrients in soils. Reduce tillage. And, you know, if you're a homeowner, be careful of the fertilizer that you're using. Don't over-fertilize your lands. Realize that there are streams and rivers running through your landscape. Protect riparian landscapes in communities. You know, these forests or shrublands that along the edges of rivers are really important. They play an important filter function in landscapes to maintain healthy rivers and streams in landscapes. So I think understanding that what we do has an impact off of the land that we're managing and understanding what we can do to minimize those negative effects on what we're doing is really the approach people need to take as they manage their lands and make decisions about their land.
That is Lou Verschow, who is the lead scientist for restoration of degraded landscapes at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And this conversation is part of Covering Climate Now, a collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world. You can hear more of our stories on climate change at hereandnow.org.
In November 2016, a pair of Russian teens in love ran away from home, boarded themselves up in a cabin, and had an armed standoff with police and special forces. They then streamed the episode live. The story is now being told in an unusual opera named after the two teens. Denise and Katya is being premiered by Opera Philadelphia, and Jeff London has the story behind the work.
Ted Huffman wrote the libretto and directs Denise and Katya. He first learned about the teens on his Facebook newsfeed.
And it was total clickbait, and I clicked on it because the headline was something about Romeo and Juliet, and it was that pic of two of them holding guns, and I just thought, what is this? And I went and read the story, and then the story really stayed with me, and I sent the link to Phil.
Phil is composer Philip Venables.
It was a very intriguing story, and on one level, almost a kind of classic tale, but of course tragically real, and in another way, very relevant to the way that we live our lives in these kind of two parallel worlds now, the real world and our online world.
So that's how they decided to tell the story, from the outside. Denise and Katya aren't on stage. Multiple characters describe what happened, including a journalist who covered the story.
They spoke to users.
The writers went to Russia to do interviews, including with Denise's best friend.
He agreed, but I wasn't sure if he will come or not.
Ksenia Ravina is the piece's co-creator and translator. The friend did show up, and she spent several hours with him. He told her that he communicated with Denise and Katya throughout the whole thing while watching the live stream.
What he said to me, because of course I asked him, he said for him it wasn't real, I think. As everybody, I think he just thought, okay, they went a bit crazy, but they will come out, of course, and everything will work out, and of course they would be punished, but nobody thought that it can end like this.
The best friend is one of two main characters in the opera.
Katya's mom, she called.
Denise and Katya holed up in her father's cabin. Since he was a member of Russian special forces, there was a cache of guns. There was also alcohol. The kids found themselves surrounded and began shooting out of the window, says librettist Ted Huffman.
You can tell they don't know how deep they are in, and neither do we. The viewers don't know whether they're watching something real, whether these are just kids who are saying that there are police outside. And so I think for us, that also helps get to this question of the internet and how we all accept information or not.
Information is presented in bits and pieces, all played by two singers, switching roles from moment to moment.
We were definitely thinking about documentary films where you're cutting between different talking heads. And so that informed kind of the form, is this idea of cutting like a documentary would.
The role of the journalist is sung by Sienna Licht Miller. Miller also plays a teacher, a neighbor who observes the event. To prepare for the role, she watched a video of the live stream.
And that's when it clicked. This is a tragedy. This is so wrong in so many ways. But unfortunately, that's like what we see constantly in our world. In live stream, we've seen deaths and we become slightly desensitized to it. So it shocked me also how much I wasn't shocked.
There is no video of Denise and Katya's death. The official story is that they committed suicide before the special forces entered the cabin, but there's doubt. Theo Hoffman, who sings the best friend, among other roles, says he wonders.
Would they have died if they didn't live stream it? If they weren't performing for an audience, would it have escalated so far? And so in that respect, it's a reminder that the internet is fake, quote unquote, but people treat it in a very real way and react to it in a very real way.
The opera's creators debated whether to project pictures of Denise and Katya. They concluded that the audience can Google them if they'd like. You can, too. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in Philadelphia.
And we've had some gracious hosts this week at the studios of KJZZ here in Tempe, Arizona. A special thanks to Jason Cannell, Brian Mendez, and Mark Nearboss for their technical help. They've gotten up so early in the morning and been so bright and professional. Thank you so much. And in the newsroom, thanks to Michel Marisco, Brett Jaspers, and Al Macias and John Hoban. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I know you're there with Arizona's own Peter O'Dowd, who knows all the best Mexican food places.
I know, and how can I forget to say thank you, Peter, has been
thank
my
you,
savior
Peter.
All week. Thank you, Peter.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.